Hello there. Welcome to episode 39 of Bow and Blade, a podcast brought to you by Medievalists.net, your home for all things medieval on the internet. Bow and Blade gives you a seat at the bar as scholars of medieval warfare go beyond the Wikipedia articles to talk about the debates and questions that we're working on today. I'm Michael Livingston, Distinguished Professor at the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina.
And I'm Kelly DeVries, Distinguished Visiting Professor at the Air Force Academy and Professor of History at Loyola University. 39, Mike. 39.
39 episodes. 39 episodes.
You know what that means?
What's that?
Q&A.
Yes, our next episode is going to be a Q&A. Episode 40. Look, people, give us questions, man. There's thousands of you, apparently.
Yeah.
They listen to this podcast every week. We need more questions. We get great questions from you.
We get great questions.
Yeah, we do. Keep them coming. We never want to run out, and we shouldn't ever run out. There's too much to talk about.
When we started this is Mike's suggestion. Every five we'd do a Q&A. This was way back when, and I thought, that could be a wasted one. I mean, we're not going to get questions. We're not going to get reviewed. And I have a lot of fun answering these questions.
Yeah, they're great. And, so often we're like, then that's a great question.
That's
we don't
a great
know.
Question, yeah. And they go in waves. I mean, one group will get is leadership. One group will be recruitment. One group's technology. It's like you all are thinking on the same wavelength out there.
It's good stuff. It's good stuff. So, send us more. So we got more stuff to talk about. We can talk about just about anything for a while, but it's more fun when it's stuff that you guys want us to talk about. That's
exactly.
Really cool.
And
related too, if you guys have, battle requests or siege requests, for us to do a main episode on, let us know. We have a very large list, but we have been known to move things around on their list.
And we haven't done a siege for a while, have we?
We've not done a siege for a while.
Yeah, so that would be good.
We've sort of mentioned in passing and been like, like our last episode with Agincourt was like, well, we're not going to talk about Siege of Harfleur. We probably should at some point.
We've got to talk about Siege of Harfleur,
and we just moved on.
It's fun. I mean, I must admit, Agincourt or the Henry V play. I think Shakespeare has some of his best lines in. But some of them are related to Harfleur. Was the Back to the Breach.
Once more onto the breach, my friends.
Once more
that's good
on
stuff,
breach,
man.
My friends. Yeah,
that's good stuff. We're not talking about a siege today.
No. We're talking. No. In fact, this is. So here's a question in anticipation of next week. Mm-hmm. What medieval battle do you think is the most influential but the least well known?
Loaded question because it's our topic today.
It is our topic today. I discovered in grad school. This is where I discovered Bouvines, Battle of Bouvines, in grad school. I was just laughing with Mike in the beginning. I said, I wrote a paper. I still got the paper. I scanned it in later on because it was done on a typewriter, believe it or not. And I had to read Georges Duby's book, little book on Bouvines in French. About 2 months later, it comes out in an English translation. I thought, I should have postponed the paper for a year.
Battle of Bouvines, man. This battle is like astoundingly important, and so few people kind of know about it or understand it. Maybe it's something with the bees, like Brunenburg is that way. Bouvines, maybe it's something with those.
Yeah, that's. It's true. Bannockburn.
Bouvines is just incredible, and it's an incredible fight too. Just kind of how this happens,
huge with huge repercussions.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a huge buildup. When I was doing my bibliography way back when or starting it out, I had to put Bouvines in its own category because of all the allies. I couldn't actually put it. Is it a Holy Roman Imperial battle?
Yeah.
Is it a French battle? Is it a Low Countries battle? Is it an English battle? Is it the Pope?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this one's a wreck. But That's why it's so amazing.
It is, yeah.
Bouvines 1214. What are you drinking tonight at the bar?
Well, this is a hard one because I do favor the Flemings in this, even though they're led by. This is the first time they've got a countess on the throne. Joanna Constantinople is on the throne, and her husband is Ferrand of Portugal, and he is actually the Count of Flanders. So she is the countess. She's the one who's got a. He's the count. So I would be, a prince of Portugal. I'd, be going definite Portuguese red. But it is a Low Countries one. There's a lot of nobility lost. And I just have to assume they're drinking creaking beer. So maybe I'll just have a red beverage and call it beer or a creek or a red wine, a Portuguese red.
Yeah, I mean, you got to pour one out for that side for sure. Because this does not go.
Yeah, I don't like great. The winners in this one, I'm afraid.
I mean, I got to have a good French wine.
Yeah.
You know, because they won.
They do win.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. But look, we're talking about history. We can't really spoil anything, can we?
No, that's right. When we start announcing, not that the battlefield has changed, but the winner has, then we're talking. We're taking on a lot of controversy here.
I did an interview. I can't remember now. Some podcast for Agincourt in the past week, and the person who was hosting it said, "Yes, you've changed everything." And I was like, "No, the English still win, man. Like, actually, didn't change that much." But yeah, there was.
You've just moved it from one side of the road to the other. Essentially,
it's like 1,000 yards. It's not that big a deal.
But was it the Times that had that? Agincourt is not where we think it was. And I'm thinking, it kind of is.
Sunday Times. yeah, that's not something I thought I'd ever see.
No. Michael Livingston, the man who moves battlefields around.
Oh, God. And I immediately got flooded with emails that day that were, some of them were rather hateful, which I'm used to. That's fine. But then there were quite a few that were like, "Oh, thank God, somebody who will fight the man. Here's my conspiracy theory on battle X, Y, or Z."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Oh, okay, we'll see how this goes." So,
Now, Agincourt's of course, a good book. Everyone out there, if you haven't got a copy, Agincourt's of course, a good book.
Thank you. Yeah. Go buy your copies. Bouvines is not in that book.
No,
Bouvines is not in that book. It's in the book I'm working on now, but that's neither here nor there. This is a battle that, like, okay, we need to set the stage for this. As Kelly said, like, this is a, what do you even label this as? Who's it even between? Gets to be a mess because there's so many different players.
Yeah, it's almost a world war for what Europe was at that time. The number of different armies that are involved. I mean, basically. Everybody between the Pyrenees and the Alps.
Yeah, it pretty much is. I think the main thing that I would start with in setting this up for everybody, I would say, is the French side.
Yeah.
I think that's a decent place to start, which is Philip the Second, Philip Augustus, as he comes to be called, Philippe. King of France, and look, he's done well for himself.
Oh yeah.
And that's
the one who comes out of the Third Crusade, not dead or almost dead.
Yeah. He ditches the Third Crusade, leaves Richard the Lionheart out there, comes back to France and immediately gets John Lackland, right? John Soft Sword. He gets different names.
Yes.
None of which are good.
Well, part of the reason he gets Lackland is because of what Philip does when he gets back from the Crusade.
Yeah, Philip plays that family like a drum. It's amazing how well he's got their number on how to get those brothers. First of all, get them at their father and then get them at each other. And he's constantly playing these guys. Really, I mean, it's really, really phenomenal. You know, it's good political work.
Yeah.
And, you know,
do you think, I mean, this is, okay, I'm going to throw a conspiracy in there.
Okay.
Philip's father was Eleanor of Aquitaine's first husband.
Uh-huh.
They have no children. Eleanor and Louis have no children. Eleanor remarries Henry the second, has four boys, a number of girls. So Philip, you think he's kind of, you know, got dear old dad. He's trying to build up for dear old dad's lost honor.
I mean, look, almost all these guys got daddy issues.
That's
I
true.
Mean, honestly, one way or another, it's always like, well, but I'm going to show him. I'm right now writing on a later Philippe, and about how he's mad at his dad, Philippe, you know, like daddy did this and I'm going to do it different. And so you suddenly get Philippe LaBelle.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Darn, I was onto a whole, you know, conspiracy there. Yeah, gonna throw it out, you know.
Yeah,
Philip the second, is he really the child of Eleanor and Louis?
No.
No. Oh, darn. Okay.
No. Yeah, but I definitely think he's, you know, he's got that extra sort of axe to grind here. And but, you know, look, he also just, this is a family of egos that it's pretty easy to sort of put a wedge in them. And he knows how to do that. And, you know, the end kind of result of all that is the great diminishment of what we call the Angevin Empire, even though it was never called that and was never an empire. But history has labeled the Angevin Empire. Greatly reduced, and ends up in the hands of John Lackland, Softsword, etc. And he's mad at Philip Augustus.
Yeah, John's mad at the world.
Yeah,
but Philip Augustus has come back. I mean, Philip did what he was not supposed to do, which is start picking on the English lands of France once he comes home from the Crusades. That's an oath he had taken with the Pope.
Yeah,
I know. It's one of those soft oaths.
Yeah.
It's Philip's soft oath.
I mean, look, Philip's not a great guy.
No, he's not. Although it's very interesting. So I encountered this in a different way. I encountered this battle originally in a different way. So I'm very much into Low Countries history, as you well know, and started out in graduate school. I was doing Low Countries history, and I ran across Bouvines because of the Low Countries and the Holy Roman Imperial involvement. So France was kind of an afterthought. You know, there had to be an enemy. And France is going up against some rebellious French nobles. And the Emperor, Louis IV, who's not well-liked. Not Louis IV, Otto IV.
Otto IV, yeah, not
Otto IV. He's not well-liked. But there are these low country principalities he has that will also enter on the side. But I encountered it initially because in 1212 there is a declaration of war. And I found the declaration of war in a printed book. It no longer, unfortunately, exists. Destroyed in one of the world wars. But it's a declaration of war that begins by attacking Philip. You know, we're going to declare this war because of what you've done. But by the second line, it's what the Pope has done. And the whole declaration of war is on the Pope and the fact that Philip and Pope are so close in this matter. Innocent III.
Yeah, I mean, which is kind of the reason I wanted to start with Philippe, because by this point, he's basically made everyone mad. Aside from the Pope. Though even that, sometimes the Pope's mad at him too. I mean, He has angered all of these people to the point that they're like, you know what? Let's stop fighting each other. Let's go get that dude. And so you mentioned the Low Countries, and you mentioned this in our kind of, you know, intro, as it were, Ferrand of Flanders.
Yeah.
Like what happens with this guy is bonkers. That he becomes the enemy of France. So I mean, where do you even start with that? Where do you even start with that kind of whole weird story?
Exactly. I mean, Ferrand de Flanders has not been Count of Flanders long. In fact, he marries he marries Joanne in 1212, and this battle is almost immediately he declares war. He adds his name as the top French rebellious noble against the king in 1212. He's just out of Portugal.
Well, he marries Joan, and that's an arranged marriage by Philippe. He arranges this marriage. She has like grown up in the household, not necessarily by her choice, but because that's a whole story.
Well, her dad had gone off to Constantinople, was the first king
and died.
Latin king of Constantinople, then disappeared. He shows up. Somebody shows up at the beginning of Joan's reign and says, "Oh, by the way, I'm dear old dad." And there was nobody knew and had seen William what is his name?
Baldwin.
The ninth.
Yeah, Baldwin.
For decades, and he shows up. Oh, could be, I guess.
Yeah, that whole story is just amazing. Just amazing. But yeah, there's this pretender guy. The whole thing is insane. And the end result of it or whatever is that she grows up in the protection of the French court, and there's an arranged marriage to Ferrand. This is all going to work out great. Won't it be swell? They get married. Everything's great. And when the new bride and groom, the new count, so he's now Count Ferrand, she's Countess. When they're headed home to Flanders, they get kidnapped and thrown in prison by the heir of the person who just married them. So yeah. Philippe's heir kidnaps them and imprisons them and won't let them go until they sign over all these lands to him. And so as a result, as soon as they get out of hock, they're like, forget this.
Yeah.
We're ready to kill the king of France. Like, what? This is insane.
You think Ferrand read that when he did? Oh, you get to marry the Countess of Flanders here, Ferrand. You're a younger prince of the king of Portugal, and you're going to go off and marry this woman who's reputed to be pretty, beautiful woman.
Yeah.
But she's also in control of huge amounts of land. And this is at the time when Eleanor of Aquitaine has brought all that land to England. So, he must have, been rubbing his hands in the they don't make it even from Paris to Flanders without being caught and tossed into jail.
It's just like, what? Yeah. Right. And meanwhile, Otto the Fourth, as you mentioned, he's like got a anger thing now going on where he's mad, because he's got a rival for the Holy Roman Empire and the French king is supporting the other guy. So forget that. I want to get him. And so you have all these people who ultimately just get together and say, like, let's get Philippe Augustus, really.
Yeah.
And that's how you get this bizarre, it really is a pretty bizarre alliance.
Well, and even just the whole reason why Otto's been elected, just like any other Holy Roman Emperor should have been. But Innocent III has raised Frederick II down in Sicily in southern Italy and says, I'd rather have my boy up there. So this is where the Pope gets involved in it too. And, oh,
right.
Yeah.
And so we get this fight that also is not sort of planned to happen this way. So there's a grand strategy that they decide on. And the strategy is basically all of us in the Holy Roman Empire, Flanders, we're all going to kind of get together and we're going to attack France from the north, or the northeast to be more specific. And meanwhile, Johnny Boy, King of England, is going to attack from Gascony,
right?
Down the southwest, right? And we're going to this is a big pincer movement, right? But that totally gets screwed up.
John is he doesn't operate very quickly. He does send William of Salisbury over to this coalition of forces that are getting together up in the north. So he does have a presence there. But yeah, he's supposed to be attacking either in Normandy or in Aquitaine.
And he attacks from Aquitaine, but gets bogged down.
Yeah.
And they don't, and the northern contingent doesn't get their horse and gear to get attacking. So by the time he has to withdraw, now here they come. Mm-hmm. So there's no coordination. So the King of France is able to, he doesn't have to fight on two fronts. He's able to kind of, you know, repulse the southern attack and then turn around and head up north.
Yeah. And it is curious because Philip has taken Normandy in 1203-04. I mean, so he took Normandy post Richard dying, and now he's making these inroads into Aquitaine, and John has to respond. And yeah, whether it was just a failure of a coordinated attack or a failure of John to really sustain an attack on Philip in Aquitaine, and I think there's a lot to be done on this battle. Let's say it.
Yeah,
because it covers so many different lands and has so many different causes to bring them all together. It hasn't been done very well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some good work on it. I mean, yeah, John of France, John of France.
Yeah,
love you, John. John France of France. Yeah, John France has got a fantastic article on Bouvines, and actually a really great chapter in his last book. He does a good chapter on Bouvines, dealing with it militarily. And you know, a little bit on the politics, but yeah, there's still a lot left to be done on this for sure. Yeah.
And unfortunately, Duby's book is not particularly good. I don't think. I mean, he just follows the one source that we have from Philip's court, and you know, makes a big do about this being fought on a Sunday and everything. But it's unfortunately been the standard for too long.
Yeah, it's definitely something where you have to step outside of the kind of the traditional strain of sources because it is so international.
Yeah, exactly.
You're really missing the picture if you're not really getting into the papal materials and you're not getting into the Flemish materials and things. Because, yeah, there's so much happening here kind of all at once. You know, Renaud de Bouillon is there. Like
his story is amazing too.
Yeah. It's insane, is what
and
it is.
Hugh Beauvais, this kind of wannabe. I mean, if Hugo Beauvais had been born in the Hundred Years' War, I think we'd be looking at him like a Bertrand de Guesclin or you know, somebody along those lines. And instead, he's a really important warrior who goes down to defeat because he chooses the wrong side here.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of guys go down in defeat in this battle. For sure. It's a couple of massive armies that begin sort of dancing towards each other. I think in what I've just written, I estimate 6,000 men and 1,400 cavalry. But there are some that have much larger numbers than that. And here I'm thinking about Philippe's side, the French side. Some folks have bigger numbers than that. Probably the allies. I guess we'll call them the allies. Is that the best way to describe
it? Yeah, I think it's the best way to describe it because it really is. It's the German Emperor, the King of England, the Count of Flanders, the Count of Bologna, the Duke of Brabant, the Count of Holland, the Count of Lorraine, the Duke of Limburg. I mean, they're just list. In fact, the signatories to this declaration of war. There's got to be 12 names on there of, I mean, we're talking about principality type lords. We're, you know, not just the guys that are hanging on that are in a retinue. And it's so it is a pretty massive force. And the battle itself is very interesting. I mean, this is one where I wish we had the battlefield. I went one time and there's nothing I could see that would correlate because the rivers have changed, irrigation has changed.
Yeah.
Everything has changed. There's one little tiny church that has stained glass windows that were put up in like the early 20th century of things, the battle, and they are really funny to see because whoever was doing them had no concept what a medieval soldier looked like.
Nice. Nice. Do you think, I mean, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but the fact that this coalition is so international.
Yeah.
Do you think that's part of the reason that they lose, right? That having command and control with this kind of disparate, you know, language, disparate leadership, do you think that's a problem?
Yeah, it's, you know, that's one that's been put forward, not by Duby and not necessarily by John France, but in looking at it, it's hard not to look at the command structure on the Allies forces and give the fact that Philip is a sole leader. The Pope is there in spirit, but he's not there in body. And what Philip's, you know, there's a commander in chief on the one side. There are commanders and not chiefs on the other side. Part of the way is that the way it breaks down, that we don't have a single phase where everybody gets to the battlefield, lines up, waits a while, and then moves in. The initial part of the battle, the way that I looked at it when I was a grad school, and is that there seems to be three phases of the battle. And the first is knights on knights, and we're talking knights here. We're talking about the nobility of Flanders, the nobility of Brabant, the nobility of Germany that are on horseback, that are riding, you know, fully armored and armed against other knights. And then the second phase is kind of a mixture of the infantry that are just rising on the battlefield. And then the final phase is just the last infantry that arrive on the battlefield. But I'm ready to be corrected. And you know, somebody suggests to me that it is more of a conventional battle and that Philip just overwhelmed him.
Yeah, I certainly don't think it is. I'm with you. I don't think this is conventional. And in fact, it's a fun battle, and it is unfortunate, as you said, that we don't have, the topography anymore, because it is a battle that is largely defined by its topography, which is in particular this river, and Bouvines. The reason it's important at all is because this is where the bridge is to cross this river. It's not a big river, the Marque. It's not very big. You can see it on your Google Earth or whatever today. It's a small town. Bouvines is between Lille and Tournai.
Yeah. Part of the county of Flanders at the time, but not afterwards.
Yeah. Not afterwards. And there's this little town, and you can see on satellite or whatever mapping you use, you can see La Marque. You can see this little river.
Yeah.
It would have been, you know, prior to drainage and canalization and all that, it would have been a little wider, a little bit marshier. But, you know, regardless, you're moving forces, you want a bridge. And this is where the bridge was on the main road through this area. And it looks like what happens, the start of the battle, is Philippe is trying to get his forces across that river to use it as a, right, this is going to be a defensive line, right? You know, I'm on the other side of the river from you. Ha ha, what are you going to do? And he's about half done with that movement when here comes the vanguard of the other army.
Yeah.
And yeah. That vanguard, as they typically are, as Kelly just implied, on horseback. And they think smartly, right? And this is also a battle where it seems like most folks are kind of like making good moves. They think, well, we'll charge in because they're split in half, right? They're at half strength.
Yeah.
And we'll kind of overrun the guys on this side of the river and demolish them. And Philippe makes a bold move of his own.
Yeah.
What's the bold move he makes?
He charges at him. I mean, he knows that, you know, they've had to cross the bridge. Philippe has come up from the south, so he hasn't had to do it. I think, you know, you asked the question about the command structure. But this front group appears to be very, very young. young knights, inexperienced knights. Whereas there are veterans of the Third Crusade on Philip's side. There are veterans on all of these wars he's had against the English, against Richard Lionheart, and then against John. As far as I can tell, Ferrand has never, ever been in a battle. And he's commanding this first group because Otto is in the second. Otto doesn't cross the river. And I think Ferrand expects he's going to come over here, put his horse, wait for the infantry to come in line. And Philip says, yeah, guess what, guy?
Yeah. A charge into a charge.
Yeah.
and really, you know, Philippe kind of doesn't have a lot of choice. I mean, he can get across the river no problem and get to safety, but he'll be leaving behind all these men, and he's going to lose them. And so and this is kind of a bold move. Well, instead, I'll charge the people who are kind of charging at me, and maybe stop them from coming, and then the rest of my army can get across and we can line up. And it works.
It does work. Yeah.
It works. He charges out and we get this and repulses the vanguard charging at him. And they all just kind of pull rein. And then we get something like a setup for a battle.
Yeah.
As the French are pulling their army into position.
And Otto's now arrived with the infantry and his cavalry. Yeah.
Right. So now we're getting kind of the gather up. And it looks like we're going to get a sort of basic pitched battle. Probably with the center literally on the road. Probably as this is center on the road and the army's stretching to left and right of the road. With the French have their backs to the mark. Are we with it so far? Is that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is where we need more, I think. More study about it. This is where I would love to know what the surface that Ferrand and the knights on the Flemish and Brabantese and other, the vanguard. If they're on slippery terrain, because it does, you're right. I mean, Philip has anchored his army on the road. And so he's going to be entering from dry terrain. If Ferrand is over by the river, and if they, you know, so if the terrain's at all damp there, then the decision, I mean, the tactic has got to go Philip's way. But if it is not, if it's fairly solid ground, then it may just be the inexperience of Ferrand. You know, you can do whatever practice you want as a medieval knight, as a medieval commander. You can do whatever practice you want, but there is a difference being on a battlefield and watching horse charge into you and you're trying to respond. And he doesn't do it well.
Well, and again, it, you know, could be Franz's fault, but it also could be, you know, in this international coalition, you know, I might be yelling at you to do something. If you don't understand it, like, you know, we have a major problem, right? Whereas the other side, as you said, does not have that problem. These guys have worked together. They all speak the same language. They're all like, I don't even need to say it. I can look at you and you know what you're doing. You know, I mean, like veteran work on the field has that. And you know, we can actually see bits like this. I mean, even in sport, right? You know, that a couple teammates who've worked together a lot, you know, just with a look, you know, you're going to do this, right? And I can do this and boom, you know, we get the point or whatever. I mean, the same kind of thing can hold true even on the field. And when you have this hastily drawn together group that is not, as you said, has not had much experience, that's experience tends to win out. Doesn't always, but tends to win out for this very reason. And
I think, you know, the way I read the sources is that Ferrand is not expecting an engagement initially when he gets across the bridge. He's hoping the reinforcements are going to come across and everything. And I may be wrong, but I have to go back and look at it. But the lack of experience, and I think you make a good point about the language, because everybody's going to be speaking French on that side, except for the Germans and the Brabantese may well be speaking a Germanic Dutch. And then you've got, years ago, I mean, we're talking about the 30s, 40s of 20th century, a man by the name of Warlock did a very interesting collection called The Nobles of Flanders to 1300. And he did it genealogically, and he discovered many lines end at Bouvines,
so
and
many.
they're Flemish lines. They're ones who would not necessarily have spoken French first, but Flemish. And you've got that led by a Portuguese who probably knows French, but not very well, and has a distinct accent. The Bolognese have distinct accent. The Brabantese and the Flemings are not speaking entirely the same Dutch. And then Philip on the other side. I think it's a very good point that's never been made before.
So, you know, when these lines finally kind of, you know, we do sort of form up and we look like we're going to do something. The battle, kind of main battle then, opens with another cavalry charge that Ferrand leads on the south side of the battlefield. And there's a bit of a back and forth. This is not a wipeout, but pretty, yeah, after a while, this does go bad. And one of the things that's striking about it is that it looks like when Ferrand's sort of wing goes in, none of the rest of the army does. This is a bit like what we just had with Adrianople, where you get like somebody charges in and the rest of the army doesn't go in as well. You know, is this an attempt at kind of probing? Is it failure of communication? What's happening here? But the end result is that Ferrand is unhorsed and surrounded and has to surrender.
He surrenders very early in the battle, and some of his nobles do. Some do try to recover around the imperial forces around the Count of Boulogne, who are on the other. The imperial forces now made it onto the battlefield. They're in the center, and but they're infantry led. They're majority infantry in those, where Ferrand has no infantry support. He really is. It is interesting that you bring up Adrianople, because it's the same thing. Cavalry rushing in, no infantry support.
Yeah. And kind of same result. I mean, you know, they give it a good go. I mean, it does appear that, you know, Ferrand, you know, it strikes a pretty heavy blow, and this kind of goes back and forth for a bit. But in the end, he gets surrounded. A lot of his lords killed, and others have to surrender with him. And the Flemings break. Like, there goes that whole section of the army. And then Otto in the center kind of goes in. Dude, this all should be happening at once. You got to have coordination here. But he goes into the center because he's trying to get at Philippe, who's in the center. And this is, you know, to give credit where it's due, you know, the leaders are leading from the front.
All of them are.
Yeah, on both sides. Otto makes a play for Philippe and nearly gets him.
I mean, Otto is not bad on this. He gets a bad rap, mostly because he loses. Then he loses the empire within, you know, this. He'll never recover from this battle. That's more of the influence, you know, we'll have to end with. But he moves forward with this infantry. It's a tight, well-formed group. They do have some experience. Some of these would have been, you know, Frederick Barbarossa's troops earlier. Some of them would have been a little more experienced in just having fought different fights. And they seem to move in a unit, well-coordinated unit, whereas Ferrand's charge does not seem well-coordinated or well-communicated. So he is making moves as infantry troops would and against an army that can't use the charge. Philip is really kind of, at that point, horses are not moving. The infantry that he has are not moving. It's a huge melee in the middle. It's kind of been a tournament on one side with the horse against the horse. Now we've got the melee going on in the middle.
And it's brutal. And many of the sources we have focus on this moment, on this melee.
Yeah.
Because it's so brutal. The like there's a guy named Stephen Longchamp, who's mentioned in a poem. He's mentioned other sources too, but like there's this amazing poem that talks about like the violence of this, and says before the eyes of the king, you know, so it's saying like right there in front of the king. This is how close it all was. Stephen Longchamp, an honest and faithful soldier, was slain with a knife thrust into his head through the slits of his helmet. So that's fun. So that's good times.
Yeah, good times. And he must have really been, you know, you wonder if Stephen's on the ground at that point. Is that how they get it? Or is it just an awkward thrust that somebody gets in the eye hole of a helmet?
I pictured him being on the ground, but yeah, I mean, in a melee, I mean, stuff gets crazy, and that's usually the reason you don't want to be in one. But Otto is pushed so hard that he almost, I mean, he's gotten that close to Philippe.
Yeah.
But doesn't get there.
No.
And the tide starts to turn.
Yeah.
Especially because now this, with the Flemings in retreat on one side of the field, Philippe can bring those men to bear on this. This is why you coordinate your attacks. This is why this happens.
Oh, yeah.
So you don't enable your opponent to, you know, fight with extra strength. And so Otto has to pull back. And this, you know, this becomes kind of a good lesson for often how, and we've mentioned this before, you know, how quickly battles in the Middle Ages turn to rout.
Yeah, they really do.
And they do, because so much of this is psychological, and so much of this is, you know, the difficulty of communication.
Yeah.
Right. At Hastings, you know, having to lift the helmet, you know, no, I'm still alive. You know, William, you know, turn around. I'm still alive. We're okay. Don't retreat. And here, as soon as Otto's banner starts pulling back to probably coalesce, right? To probably, regroup and hit again. We almost got him, you know, regroup, close the lines, let's do this. But as soon as that banner starts coming backwards, it's like all hell breaks loose.
Well, we got to remember the knights, the Low Countries knights have already fled.
Yeah.
They're already either off the battlefield because they're still on horses, or they're running off the battlefield. And Otto's been able to keep the center together. And now they're starting to move back. And I think you're right. I think they're going back. Otto's pulling it back, regroup, and let's punch ahead. J.F. Verbruggen believes that Philip had gotten so close to Otto's gotten so close to Philip that they've unhorsed the king, the French king. I'm not sure I've seen the evidence suggesting that he was unhorsed, he was close. So I think you're absolutely right. Otto is regrouping, but he can't because now they see the flight starting.
Yeah, yeah. Because even though he might be intending one thing, but everybody else on the field is seeing the banners going backwards. Mm-hmm. We are in retreat. And once they start to retreat, a mistake or misunderstanding becomes reality.
Yeah, it does.
Really becomes reality. And that sort of panic hits in because, look, the last thing you want to do is be the last person on the field. You know, getting off a medieval battlefield is a bit like outrunning a bear, right? You need to be faster than the other guy.
Yeah, exactly right. we're talking about troops here that are, you know, that are realizing that they've got to get off the battlefield, that this is not going the way they are. Now, it's curious to me because, again, now this is when the third phase of the battle starts because the Renaud of Boulogne, his wing is still standing there. They haven't gone into battle yet, and they don't flee. So they
should have.
They should have. And this is one where, again, the language must come in because his are all speaking French. And the guys who are shouting commands in the Senate now have got to be speaking German. And, you know, if you're in Boulogne, you do not understand German, I can promise you. because they seem to react by moving forward as these other two groups are moving back.
Yeah. And, you know, this could be they're trying to, you know, salvage the situation, right? There's I've seen some people say that they're trying to cover the retreat. They're trying to sort of, you know, stem the pursuit. To let Otto get off the field, that seems awfully unlikely to me.
Yeah, I think so too.
But I mean, that people have thrown that out there. But you know, this doesn't work for them either, because no, now it's like them against Philippe's army.
Right.
You're not going to win.
No.
It's not like, this isn't like Thermopylae where you got some beautiful little bottleneck you can hold. Like, this is an open field.
Well, there's one other thing that I wonder about that, because this element, this wing now, it's got the English are in it as well as the Bolognese. Both Philip would consider, well, maybe not the English, but he certainly would consider the Bologne to be rebels. And so I wonder how much they recognize that if they get caught as rebels, that they're going to be executed.
I don't know. I mean, there's, I mean, probably everybody assumes if they get caught, they're going to die unless they're a lord, you know, right. You know, you're right. Not good unless you can be ransomed. I mean, they make a hell of a stand, you know,
they do. Brabantes and the Bolognese kind of form this odd standing position surrounding the Count of Boulogne.
Yeah.
Everybody else leaving the battlefield.
Sometimes it gets called a chiltron. Some people say it's like a chiltron, which is
I don't think it's appropriately used here. It's
weird,
not used in the original.
But they try to hold off. But there's no, I mean, you're surrounded at this point. There's nothing you can do. And the rest of the army is all in retreat. Everybody's just trying to get away as fast as they can. And the French are just taking ransoms, or again, you know, if you're not worth money, killing you.
At best, there's 400 still of the Allies left on the battlefield, and we're talking about 2,000-3,000 French.
Yeah. Well, more than that, probably. Yeah, it's... In the end, I mean, this is a complete disaster, and it's remarkable how quickly it turns, in the sense that, you know, when Philippe sort of caught out by the river, in that initial moment, like that is the circumstances for defeat for Philippe, and that decision that he makes to charge, to kind of buys the time. For then the battle to take place in a pitched way, and then we have this kind of series of odd moves, which again I attribute to the language issue largely, and I don't know that there's any way to really prove that, but at least
lack of experience too on the ones who are there left on battlefield are the least experienced.
Yeah. Now, so Bouvines is basically over. Like that's it.
Yeah.
Now, why is this so important as a battle, Kelly?
Well, it's important if we're looking at strict military history, this is a full-fledged battle. I mean, we've got all elements there. Not a lot of archers, but we've got the cavalry and infantry, and they're fighting like cavalry and infantry, like the stereotypical cavalry and infantry that we view of the 13th century. Interesting that within a century, it's gone. Within a century, it'll be infantry on infantry. Cavalry will be supporting forces. So for that. But I find what's really interesting, what's really influential, is beyond the military aspects. It's what happens afterwards. The fact that nobody succeeds after this. Who's on the Allied side. Even the ones who get away aren't successful. Otto the IV is deposed. He has to run for his life until he dies a few years afterwards. Renaud of Damanton, the Count of Boulogne, Ferrand of Portugal, the Count of Flanders, are both imprisoned in France for 20 plus years. The nobility of Flanders are completely destroyed, which actually leads to this buildup of the sovereignty of the Flemish towns in the 13th century. It's incredibly important. Joanne is it takes over full Countess role, and then we'll pass that to her sister Margaret. Afterwards, we don't even hear about. Renaud will come back. He'll make a few sign a few things as Count of Flanders, but it's a century for countesses in Flanders. The Brabantese are for now will be starting to go towards the away from the Imperium or the Holy Roman Empire into the French orbit. And a year later, John is on the Battle of Run or on the field of Runnymede.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty direct line between this and Magna Carta. I mean, you because of this and then taxes and everything, the rebellion of the barons, boom, Magna Carta. Yeah, and I mean, it's so it, this is affecting everybody.
That is.
And it really, the point you made about the loss of sort of the leadership of the Low Countries and the effect of that in kind of increasing the power of the towns and the townspeople is so massive
It is.
because this, it's one of these bizarre things where Philippe wins. So in the short term, his control over the Low Countries is absolutely bolstered. This is like French domination, boom. The chronicler of Béthune says something like, after this, no one dared stand to Philippe Augustus. It's this fantastic, like nobody even tried. And that's true short term. But long term, the result of this is that the what the old money, if you will, of Flanders is gone, and that leadership void gets filled by the new money. Well, the new money, folks, are built on the economic engine that is tied to England.
With the wool, the
The
ties
wool trade.
between Flanders and England, between Brabant and England, will become enormous. This is when wool, a wool monopoly with the Flemish towns, cloth making towns, becomes evident.
And that then, I mean, is integral to the so-called Hundred Years' War, right? This is, because Bouvines goes the way it does, you end up with down the road the conditions for this absolutely kind of world-changing fight. Because he actually won. I mean, it's this really strange thing. Short term, what a victory! Long term, really establishes problems for France. I mean, that nobody could kind of could have foreseen, right? There's not this wasn't a mistake, but it that's how things work out. And of course, it's ruined any chance for the Angevin Empire to come back.
Oh yeah, there's no more Angevin Empire, and in essence too, this ends the Crusades. Fourth Crusade hasn't been big, but now we no longer have alliances in the Crusades, particularly after this. So the Otto falls, and Frederick the Second replaces him. Innocent has the glory returned a little bit. He comes out with a few statements. God is still with us, even though the Fourth Crusade was such a disaster. God has still come back for us, because he's on the side of me and he's on the side of our glorious French king. But they never launch a concerted combined crusade again, the kings, like the Third Crusade had been. There's just so much that comes out of this battle, because of the way it's fought, because of the way it's won. And I just remember when I was in graduate school thinking, 100 years before this battle, Charles the Good, the murder of Charles the Good in Bruges, creates a Flemish civil war between barons, between nobles. 100 years later, they're gone because of Bouvines. And 100 years later, after that is the Hundred Years' War, where we get the Flemish towns basically in charge of the Flanders.
And in so many ways, determining the course of that war, right? The centrality of the Low Countries to the Hundred Years' War is not to be underestimated.
And the rise of Burgundy.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
there's it really is this kind of hinge upon which so much develops out of the history of the world, and nobody wants to see it as such. Or I won't say that. Nobody really researches it as much in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it gets overshadowed, right? It gets overshadowed. Yeah. This whole period sort of gets overshadowed, at least in Anglophone literature, right? You know, where Richard the Lionheart is gone. I guess we skip to an Edward. Let's just skip. You know, let's skip
with
there.
With a Magna Carta somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, you know, blah 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 blah. Let's skip to the good stuff. Yeah. Because this is such a turning point. You know, it really does. You know, put an end to what England had wanted to be, which is this cross channel power.
Yeah, and it has to try to regain that through 100 years of warfare. I mean, that's really it in a nutshell. I think it also, I mean, from looking at it from a French perspective, it strengthens the monarchy and it really secures ties between France and the Catholic Church more than they had been before. But that doesn't go well either, because once Philip IV comes along, Philip the Fair comes along, you know, he's going to bring the papacy to Avignon. He's going to, you know, knock out the Templars. That, you know, essentially France becoming the watchguard of the papacy, where the empire had been before and it was in chaos almost always. So papacy had a lot of its own independence. That's all gone in the 14th century.
Yeah. Though, I mean, that's got its own story, right? With Unum Sanctum and all that, you know, and how France pulls away from the papacy and then ends up, getting it in its back pocket. That's another story for another
time. That's another story, true. That's true. I harp on this since the very beginning. This is a battle that needs more research, needs more things done, and not just what has happened on the field, but these kind of spider web of influence afterwards. Because I can't think of a more influential battle in the Middle Ages that affects such a large area of Europe.
And is so little studied, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people are, you know, coming to this podcast with Bouvines. What?
Bouvines, what is that? What? Where? Yeah.
Well, hopefully we've convinced you that it's of some importance. What do you wish we had of this battle, Kelly?
Well, I looked all through Low Country sources, German sources. We don't have a lot of really good solid sources from that part of the battle. We rely, totally relied on the French accounts, primarily two that cover Philip's reign. And the English hardly mention Bouvines, which is just remarkable because it does influence a lot. I would like to have a solid Flemish Brabantese source that gave us details of what might have been thinking there, the thinking of the count. And the thinking of this whole alliance. Why did Ferrand join with Otto the Fourth? I mean, it doesn't seem at all logical.
Well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
I guess, yeah. But they don't seem to be that much enemy until, you know, Ferrand's just barely there. Maybe he didn't like the food in the prison. It was he and his wife. Joined.
They took his. They took lands from them to get out of
they
prison.
Did.
That's,
yeah, they
that's
did.
Not okay. Yeah, I wish I had, and there's probably no way to have it, but I wish I really did know for sure. The degree to which language discontinuity was a problem in command and control on that side. I mean, I'm utterly convinced of that, but I do not have the smoking gun for that, other than that makes sense. It would be so nice to have, like, you know, some eyewitness was like, I was there and I didn't understand what that, you know, bloody guy was yelling at me. And I think he was yelling at us as to hold. And I thought he meant retreat, and all hell broke loose. I wish I had that. to really kind of smoking gun it, because I do think it's so essential. And so, you know, interesting to think about, because often, you know, in movies or whatever, everybody's, the actors are all speaking the same language or whatever for the audience. And it gives this kind of impression of unity, and everything's always really easy that way. And that's not the case. And this is such a great battle for that. I really do wish I had that.
And if somebody's listening on podcast land that that knows, I mean, my understanding is of the Low Countries and we would get, but in these imperial parts of the Low Countries, how much French are they speaking? How much French is the bishopric, the archbishop, or the prince bishop of Liège speaking? Because he's coming out of Germany as well right now. So is it a situation where we've got a battlefield where we're not, there isn't a common language or even a commonly understood language by the commanders, let alone the troops? I can't imagine there's a lot of infantry in Otto's infantry who could understand French.
Yeah. And even in cases where it's like, oh, they would have spoken some French. Well, yeah, so do I. But in the heat of battle, if you're yelling at me in French, it ain't going to go well. Like, you know, it's the heat of battle, man. I need like direct and clarity. I got a lot on my mind. If I'm like, okay, so what does that mean? And let me translate that. I'm dead. So yeah, there's this, you know, oh no, everybody was spoken some French. That's not the point. Like,
yeah, no,
we need
it's
to
not
know
the point.
What it must have been like.
On top of it all, I mean, what type of accent does Ferrand of Portugal have? If he's learned French, which I would assume a prince of Portugal might have learned, I don't know, really.
Well, I think he would have. He had family that was French, but yes, his accent would have been.
His accent would have been, you know, Portuguese accents would have changed that French. Let alone if he's trying to speak, you know, his very minor Flemish that he's acquired in the 2 years he's been count.
Yeah, it. Yeah, that's what I wish I had.
I think that. Well, And you and me, and we'll have to include Bob Wisdom Savage, we're going to have to go to the battlefield of Bouvines and see if we can make any sense of it, because it's there. And to see the wacky, oh, I found out they were put in the church in 1914. So these ugly stained glass windows on the Battle of Bouvines.
All right. We'll have to go check that out. So, look, they're locking the doors on us.
Yeah. They're saying, look, for a least understood battle, you've taken a long time. Describe it again.
Yeah, that's right. I hope you all enjoyed this. Hope you all did, as ever. And please do join us next time when we're going to be doing, as I said, our eighth Q&A. Send in those questions. So, as ever, a reminder, this podcast is sponsored by medievalist.net. So the best way to support us, other than buying our individual books, of course, is to join their Patreon at patreon.com/medievalists. That's also the absolute best place to drop us a question for our Q&As.
Absolutely.
Hope to see you next time, everybody. Cheers.
Happy birthday, Mike.
Thanks.